Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me, and you get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, then you are in the right place. Because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today on my show, Claire Oshetsky and their brand new novel, Evil Genius. I am obsessed with this book. I literally cannot stop talking about it. I can't wait to share it with you. We're also launching our brand new segment, The Book Biz. This is where we look at the forces shaping what gets written, published, and read. Something I also can't stop talking about. We kick off with Rachel Cantor, owner and founder of Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're going to talk to her about the explosion of romance bookstores like hers and how they're changing the book-selling landscape. But first, let's talk to Claire Oshetsky, author of the novel Evil Genius. And I'm trying really hard not to fangirl here. I've been obsessed with the book and the main character, Celia, since I picked the novel up a few months ago. Claire's work is often called dark, arresting, unsettling, and that pretty much sums up Evil Genius. I'm just so excited to have you on here, Claire. Welcome to Check This Out.
Thanks for inviting me, Rachel. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Okay, so before we dive into this interview, I need to let listeners know that there are scenes in the novel that include domestic violence. If you or somebody you know needs help, you can call 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. Now, let's dive into this novel, Evil Genius, by Claire Oshetsky. It's set largely in 1974 San Francisco, and it follows Celia, who is 19 years old. And at first, your publicist sent emails saying that it's an exuberant and hilarious novel. And I have to say my first reaction was, this wasn't a funny book. I didn't think it was funny. I was so thrown off by that. Do you call this book funny?
No, I will say that I wanted to create a character in Celia that was always looking at the best possible interpretation of her life and thinking the best of the people in her life, even her husband, that she's always willing to imagine that someone has a reason for doing what they do and saying what they say. And she's very accepting of the world, maybe to her detriment, maybe to her credit. That's part of her character.
So tell me, what is this book, Evil Genius, about, Claire? Tell us about the novel and Celia.
I wrote this book pretty quickly, right after I had finished my previous novel, Poor Dear, which is unqualifiedly not funny. It's a very sad book. And it took a lot out of me. And I was talking to my husband after I finished, and I said, I just feel all drained. I don't know what to write about next. It feels like I've used up all my ideas. And he said, oh, you haven't written about your ex-husband yet. And it just set me off on a course where not only was I inspired to write about this experience that had happened many years ago to me, over 30 years ago, but I realized that I had never written about it. I had never called it abuse to myself, even. And I was inspired to write for the first time about my lived experience. And for me, the way I did that was not through memoir, but by wrapping it in a story of a character who does not stick around for 8 years. She finds a way through and to get out of a bad situation in her marriage much more quickly than I did.
It did feel very personal. And I love that you're so open about that. Thank you for being open about that personal note, because it felt like it was, you really let us into Celia's darkest parts of her life. So the book is about Celia, who marries a man that she calls my Drew. His name is Drew. And he is, from our perspective, abusive. And maybe Celia doesn't see it that way. And that must have been very hard to write.
Yes, there's a scene that is exactly what happened to me, that, again, I've wrapped it into this very fictional novel, but there's a scene of Celia on her wedding night that is exactly what happened to me. And I don't know, it was very difficult to write. I was very upset by writing it, but also it surprised me in a way that I had never written about it before, that it just was sort of in the past. I'd never really called it abuse. And so, yeah, it was quite affirming for me and healing in a way, even after all these years, to not just forget about it, but to acknowledge it and write about it.
Wow. So Celia is 19 and she's married to her Drew is 11 years older. And, you know, really the sex scenes between them are very disturbing and graphic in that there's no pleasure at all for Celia, right? And I can't imagine what that was like to write that now, knowing that this was so personal for you.
Yeah. Well, I don't have much to say about that. I like writing sex in a way that is not erotic, and that it's more like a true experience, and it's not always good. And there's a lot of character to be explored when you enter into that writing of an intimate experience where someone's emotions might not match the perfect intimate situation. I enjoyed writing them in a way, just from a technical point of view.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to a bigger view of the novel and take us to 1974, San Francisco. And the novel opens with introducing us to another domestic violence scene between Vivian Bianco and Randall Smiley. Would you read for us?
Sure. The year was 1974. I was 19 years old. Newspapers kept running a photograph of an internationally famous heiress toting a machine gun while wearing a saucy beret. One day on my lunch break, I bought a saucy beret for myself at a hat store on Market Street. There were hat stores in those days. Berets were fashionable among the radicals and the very old. The world was a noisy, crowded place in that era. You couldn't walk down a simple street without your head intersecting with a radio wave or a casual sidewalk conversation. I worked for the phone company that year in the resident billing office on the third floor of a six-floor building on 4th Street in San Francisco. Randall Smiley worked on the same floor as I did, but six rows over. Our job was to make people pay their phone bills. The job was uniquely powerful because in those days the telephone was all there was. No World Wide Web, no texting, no picture phones either, although they'd been promised to us ever since the New York World's Fair in 1964. If you wanted to speak to somebody who wasn't within shouting distance, then you talked through a box attached with a wire to a wall. Back then, the phone was so important that we who worked in the resident billing office were like harsh, cold gods. If you didn't pay on time, or if we didn't like your tone, or if you disrespected us, then we could disconnect your phone as fast as a finger snap, and you'd be dead to the world. We called it ripping your lips. We'd say, "Don't get testy with me, Mr. Customer. If you don't pay up by Friday, I'm going to rip your lips."
Claire, thank you so much for reading. That's Claire Oshetsky reading from their new novel, Evil Genius. So right from the beginning, there is violence on the page. We know from page one that there's this expression that Celia uses at work, ripping your lips. There's a very violent undertone to that. So let's talk about that overtone, undertone of violence that starts from the very beginning, because you put it in there very quietly. Did you intend to make it sort of quiet and to start the violence like that right from the beginning?
I liked the idea of starting the novel with a murder that was kind of titillating to this group of employees, that their lives are so boring and they have such a terrible job where they have to listen to customer complaints all day in this customer service center. And that they are interested in the world in kind of a unserious way. Someone has been murdered, but it's like gossip to them. They didn't know her. She did work in the same building, but it seems like an exciting thing to them. And I did use this kind of lack of reality or lack of connection to the violence of this woman's murder as a way, I guess, to emphasize Celia's own disconnection with the very real violence in her life, that she doesn't really recognize it for what it is.
And Celia's job is a position of power, because as you say in the passage that you read, if you wanted to talk to somebody, you had to use the phone, and Celia had the power to take the phone away from you.
Right. And there was a real conflict. I had this job, and I have to say that our bosses said, well, you have to be nice to people. They're our customers. But at the same time, there was this pressure to make sure that the company's not losing money and that you should disconnect people if they don't deserve more time on paying their bill. And depending on your mood, you could be mean or you could be nice and give them an extension. And it was a very strange job because you had very little power physically. You were attached to a headset and had to ask permission to go to the bathroom and so on. But you did have this power over someone's life. And I think people have forgotten how important a telephone was, that if you disconnect someone's phone, they can't get a return call from a job interview or talk to their parents across the country or call someone just for company. It really was very isolating.
You had this actual job.
Yes. Yes, I did. Actually, let me also say that someone in my company was in the same position as I put my character, Randall Smiley, that was involved in a tryst and hid under the bed when the husband came home and shot his wife. So that also happened. The phone company was kind of a wild place to work in some ways.
Oh my God, you just blew my mind. So but this is real life. Like this really happened and you were working there.
That's right. Yes.
Wow. Oh, my God. I mean, one of my questions later on was to ask you, where did all this come from? And that is unbelievable. And so you used that expression, rip your lips. That's real, too.
Yes, it was not condoned by management, but I did hear that now and then. You'd get kind of cranky by the end of the day hearing people saying that their grandmother had died that week when you had in the notes that they had died the week before. It was easy to forget that there were human beings there because it was such a stressful job.
Wow. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Claire Oshetsky, and we are talking about their brand new novel, Evil Genius. And what I loved and was fascinated by, that Celia, the character, had so much power. Celia had the power to take the phone away from you. And yet she's under the thumb of these men on the Diaz looking down at her. And also she is under Drew's thumb. So this is her much older husband. Tell us about Drew and how they came to be together.
Drew works as a scrub tech in a hospital. And when Celia's mother gets ill, the mother knows she's going to die and kind of arranges for Drew to become she hopes Celia's caregiver and rock. She just thinks that would be wonderful to have this older man with a caring job to be there for her daughter. The father's out of the picture. And so she arranges for the two to become engaged and get together. And Celia's a very pliant, young, naive person who thinks this is great and kind of goes along with it.
And he's very controlling. He expects Celia home at a certain time, right, and everything done just right. Like we pretty much know before we see any actual violence, we know that he is abusive, controlling from these little comments that Celia makes about her Drew from the very beginning.
Right. And, you know, it's very important to me. And I think I wrote the book to answer for myself the question of why did I stay or why do women stay? And I tried to inhabit her thinking when you look from the outside, this is obviously a terrible man, but she finds a way to excuse him or to feel like she's the powerful one in the situation because she can see his flaws and still be strong enough to be there for him, that she doesn't even feel like she's being beaten down in a way. It's more like she can endure because her man requires her to be that way. So I liked writing her sincerely. I felt like I was trying to put on the page the reason why women stay is more complicated than just that they have no power. There are other reasons, like that you feel empowered to be a helper or to be loved and to love someone that you've made a commitment to that you can overlook so much.
That's so moving and I think important to hear. And you know, I keep thinking about how in the book, Celia, the character, keeps saying, "He loves me. He loves me." She keeps coming back to that, that she believed that there was love in that marriage.
Yes, that there's no physical harm that is visible, I guess. This idea, he never hit me, he only pushed me. That's the situation I was in. And for me and for this character, the level of controlling behaviors and physical restraint that he places on her is acceptable. It's at a level that doesn't cause the alarms to go off in her head that she's being abused.
This is a really heavy interview and a very heavy subject that's in the book. And I started off this interview by telling you how much I loved this book and I was obsessed with it. And I want to be clear that what grabbed me so much about this book is you really dig into Celia's head. And I think on one hand, it's easy to sit here and maybe listen to this interview and think this is a book about an abused woman. But there's so much more to Celia than that, right? There's so much to her, so much energy, so much excitement. I felt like she was a woman who wanted to find herself and break out. And we see her in the scene and driving her mom's car, an Oldsmobile, right? Saying, "I could just keep driving. What if I keep driving?" And that is where I got obsessed with the character. And you bring us into her inner life, right? Beyond this layer. And to say, like, where is this character going? And so in your mind, right, where was she going? What was that excitement, that underlying excitement in her?
She is a person who really notices the world and thinks the best of people. And, yeah, she has a lot of drive for life and zest. And I chose to give her a trajectory in this book where she escapes what might have happened to her and that the universe complies for her and helps her in a way. But to me, I just gave her every opportunity to live in a world that wants her to have a good life. And she kind of, she's like a surfer. She meets a surfer at the end. She rides this wave of the universe complying to her will that she have a good life and that she find real love and that she can escape easily and quickly from a mistake she made. It's maybe a novel of wishful thinking on my part, you know, that she had the wherewithal and the soul and the drive to make her life better.
I don't know. She had an excitement for the world in her that we see, and we really go into her inner thoughts and, you know, this excitement in her that just made her an exciting character. My guest today is Claire Oshetsky, and we are talking about their brand new novel, Evil Genius. We see at the end of the book, there are a lot of dead bodies around the main character, Celia, right? The people who have been causing her the most trouble, let's say, are all dead, and she didn't kill anybody, right? So did she orchestrate these killings, these murders, these deaths? Like, did she make them happen or did they happen to happen? Is she reliable or unreliable? Which is part of what I loved about her character. Claire, please talk to me about all of this.
Okay, well, I'll just say in the beginning, she's very unreliable. She has an excuse. which is that she's writing from many years in the future, and she's trying to construct her memories of events that happened a long, long time ago. And she gets a lot of facts wrong. I just sprinkled in things that, you know, maybe you'd need to know San Francisco pretty well to realize that she's referring to buildings that haven't been built yet in the year that she says she was talking about. And her mother-in-law, she says, lives in a town that doesn't exactly exist in 1974. It did exist in 1959, though, and then was incorporated, and that name of the town disappeared. So there's things like that that I just put in that seem quite natural, that if you're thinking back on something many, many years ago. And then there's this other idea of did she orchestrate? And it's actually quite a reasonable interpretation of how events turn out. I just have fun with that. People telling their own stories are going to put their best foot forward, of course, and she's very good at that.
So in the end, we see Celia very far ahead in the future with her lover, Helen. And, you know, Helen's like, I think you are the evil genius, aren't you? And Celia's like, what are you talking about? and I just felt like that encapsulated the whole book, which was, you know, she's sitting there like, I would never. And yet we see from behind the scenes, like, maybe she actually did. And that dichotomy really kept the book going. And one of the ways I think you capture that is with her interactions with one of the people that she meets in her job at the phone company. Because this is another sort of moment of where she's maybe being abused, or she has no power, but she has some power, the strange dichotomy. Let's start with him.
The job of being any kind of a phone operator, someone answering when a customer calls in, was one where you just never knew who would be on the other end of the line. And men would call and know that probably they would speak to a woman. And it could be quite disturbing what they wanted to talk about. So I did create this character, the sock man, who has a sock fetish that he talks to Celia about in some detail. And she's gotten kind of inured to him and decides to meet him along with many of her friends to like set up a blind date. And she has an encounter that is transformative in a way, where she starts to imagine that he has something to teach her. And I really enjoyed writing that scene and creating that character. He's a little bit ludicrous, but also it gave me the opportunity to have Celia again show her soul, that she accepts him even with his thing about socks, that she can imagine that he's a nice person that deserves to have a good life as well.
And we see her letting loose a little, having fun.
Right. And she's 19, and it was illegal for her to be drinking. And so she's enjoying that too, a little bit of being a bad girl for the first time in her life, probably. And she has a big crowd of coworkers that have come to kind of mock this man with her. And she ends up feeling more in touch with him than with them, in a way that it was a fun scene to write.
And then I felt like it got even crazier, because then she's a little bit drunk. She gets on the train and she goes home with the man from the train station. And tell us about that scene and what happens.
Okay. So she knows she's in hot water already. She's going home late on the train. She's had a few frozen margaritas. And a man sits across from her, doesn't seem to be that interested, but the train is delayed. So she gets stuck and decides to go home with this man because she hasn't had her wild night yet. And she figures she can't go home without having something good happen. She goes to this man's house because he says he has a nice puppy that he wants to show her. And things proceed in a way that is bad for him and not for her. I'll just say that.
I mean, this is crazy. I'm going to be a little more explicit here. She, you know, she thinks that she's going to have a romantic tryst. He's trying to force himself on her. She doesn't like it. And she stabs him. And this is crazy because we have, you know, this horrible moment where suicide has stopped the train, but she decides to go home with a man and let loose, right? The juxtaposition of what's happening and to see a puppy and it turns violent. And it's just, right, all these things happening at once. It's crazy.
Well, I won't say that happened to me.
I was thinking it.
But maybe it did. She doesn't stab him, though. She just slices him. Yeah, and she thinks that makes it okay. So
I see. This is interesting that you make that very specific difference there from a stab to a slash, because it is you are accurate, but it's like that difference in her head too.
Yeah, that's right. She doesn't want to do mortal harm. She just wants to put him in his place so that she can get home, because she's changed her mind about him.
And this is what I mean by she's this fascinating character, and she has this moment of a lot of violence, but then she sort of walks out. Walks herself home.
Yes, and she seems very calm about when she needs to use violence or how to protect herself. I just wanted to make her strong enough to not be putting herself in danger any more than she was already. And I like the idea of arming her. She goes and buys a knife, this knife that was very convenient in a situation where she needed to defend herself. But why did she buy that knife? She just thought maybe she would need it. So there she goes. She was prompted to do that by, I think, this universe that's compelling her to start taking care of herself.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Claire Oshetsky, and we are talking about their brand new novel, Evil Genius. Claire, we have to talk about Barbie dolls. Barbie dolls in this book. I mean, I feel like Barbies are so far away from Celia, and yet she has a whole room filled with them. Can you please tell me about Barbie dolls and what they're doing in this novel, Evil Genius?
Well, I was thinking about the art installations of the time that women artists were using dolls and Barbie dolls in ways that were subverting the image of Barbies. And yeah, I was feeling bad about how I treated my own Barbie doll. So I decided to incorporate that into my story. And from there, it kind of grew to a point where the Barbies are, she starts to collect them and she's hyper careful of them, never takes them out of their boxes. And then her husband violates the Barbies one night and subverts her whole collection and makes it into an obscene kind of slap back because she stayed out late. That's his revenge in part, that she comes home to have all her Barbies violated by him.
And it's so violent, the way, right, that they're violated, even using that word. But we're talking about Barbie dolls. And then sprinkled in here, we hear a story about when she was a younger girl, Celia, and she had an interaction with another girl. And she was found, I guess, naked together with this girl and the reactions to that. Let's talk about Celia's sexuality and her awakening and that moment, because that was a very brief moment of the novel and yet very, very powerful too.
I thought of her as someone in need of a friend when she was young, and I constructed a scene where she is... she has a friend across the street, and in a kind of giggly way, they undress one day, and they're just joyful. They're not really thinking of it as a sexual encounter. They just are giddy with their friendship and that they have the same bodies. And then one of their mothers shows up, and it's just horrific. You can imagine this would be in like the early 60s, and the whole idea of naked girls having fun together in a bedroom was too much for the parent, and it becomes a very big trauma for both girls that they are not allowed to play together. And I just enjoyed writing the scene and foreshadowing the possibility that Celia would end up with a woman at the end of the novel.
It was one of the lightest moments, but it was so short, but one of the lightest moments. I could feel Celia's joy in that moment from being with her friend, so that when I saw her with Helen later and they were on the trampoline, like you said, that foreshadowing, those were the light moments where you saw this hope for her future in the book.
That's right.
So these were the scenes of lightness. And what we see Celia starting to grapple with as she gets further and further into the novel and through her days with Drew is, where can you go? Where will she go? What will happen next? And, you know, I love this idea. It was just past 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. What's she going to do now? It's like the whole world is open to her. So even though she's seen all this horrible violence, and she's been through this, right, these difficult situations, she still has that optimism, that excitement of where can she go? Can you talk about that as a through line there, or something that she comes to?
As a writer, I like to repeat the same phrase in different contexts as a way to convey a meaning. And at the beginning of the novel, she is trapped in this terrible marriage, and her husband Drew feels like he's the locked door. She cannot step beyond him. He's everything to her, and he will say to her, "Where can you go? There's nowhere for you to go. I'm your husband, and I will tell you what to do." And at the end, she hears his voice, and he says the same thing, "Where can you go?" And she realizes she can go anywhere, that she has complete freedom to decide, because he's not a locked door in the way of her future any longer. And that's why the exact phrase is repeated, and it means a completely different thing the second time.
That is her journey. Where can she go? And I felt like she found her freedom at the end. It was very hopeful.
That's right. I didn't want her to get off scot-free, because she does create a lot of chaos and death in her wake to self-actualization. Yeah, he deserved to die, but I didn't really want the character to take on that badness in their aura. So I chose a different route for Celia, where she gets the same outcome but is not necessarily the perpetrator.
Or is she? I mean, this is where we get to the evil genius. Right? She didn't necessarily pull the trigger, right? Or whatever, but there are a lot of dead bodies at the end. And they're all around her, and then she is free.
That's right.
And then she finds happiness with Helen.
Yeah, I wanted her to have happiness with somebody.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of this novel, Evil Genius, there is a happily ever after, which, again, I loved.
Sometimes it works out that way, so why not in a book?
Claire, this was such a personal interview, and I really appreciate how open you were and honest and talking about your own life and how closely tied it is to Celia's. Thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out and for sharing all of this.
Thank you, Rachel, for inviting me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, we're also launching our brand new segment, The Book Biz. This is where we look at the forces shaping what gets written, published, and read. We kick off with Rachel Cantor, owner and founder of Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're going to talk to her about the explosion of romance bookstores like hers and how they're changing the book-selling landscape.
Rachel Cantor, welcome to Check This Out.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. I grew up in Keene, New Hampshire, which is a small town kind of right on the border by Vermont. So being on NHPR is like a life goal.
Amazing. We love Keene, New Hampshire, and we're super excited to have you here today. Okay, usually you walk into a bookstore and there's, you know, the cookbook section and the fiction section and the nonfiction section. And a romance bookstore is obviously all romance. But what is key to it and what is so exciting is there are lots of books that you can't usually find in a regular bookstore, and also the way it's organized. And this takes us to what is so special about romance. And it's sort of like a menu you can choose from, right?
You give me the three qualities that you're looking for and chances are I can name a book for you. But yeah, I mean, one of the fun things about romance is that because it has all of these very recognizable storylines, tropes, you're able to really sort of pick and choose almost like a menu, as you said, and say, this is what I'm looking for. And the authors often are writing for that reason. They know that their readers are looking for something that's going to be predictable, that's going to be recognizable, and it's going to often offer sort of a comfort read. And so you're able to really curate your own experience by going into these subgenres.
Right. There's a lot of decision fatigue that sometimes can go into choosing a book. Mm-hmm. Also, I just want to address the elephant in the room, which is a lot of people talk about how lowbrow romance is, and which makes me so angry for many reasons. And one of the big ones is that, I mean, romance is really propping up the whole industry, both romance bookstores and romance sales, which are up 24% year over year. Like, let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's just this amazing sort of like resurgence in an industry that I think for a long time people thought was really on its way out. Brick and mortar bookstores are back. And as you said, it's really thanks in part to this explosion in romance. And it's partly because, one, we're seeing a lot more diversity in romance, both in terms of the kinds of stories that are being written and the kinds of authors that are being published. And so I think these stories are resonating with new audiences who had never seen themselves as sort of the main characters before. I also think in terms of this question about lowbrow, one thing that I really appreciate about Gen Z, and I've gotten to interact with a lot of Gen Zers, both on staff and as my customers, is that there's this kind of confidence about reading what you like and enjoying what you like and not apologizing for it. And I think that that is partly coming out of TikTok, you know, where you've got all these book talk influencers who are promoting their favorite books and they're making careers out of it. And people are seeing like, oh, it's legitimate to enjoy these things. I think the second thing is that romance is actually incredibly highbrow and well-written. Often it can be grappling with like really challenging contemporary issues. I mean, romance writers are dealing with issues of consent, bodily autonomy, class difference, socioeconomic difference. So I think that that is the stigma that is starting to wear off. But I think that increasingly people are starting to see that, oh, these authors really have something to say.
Yeah, and I think you're really hitting on a core there that I see in romance readers all the time, which is it's just fun. And romance readers are reading because it's fun.
Yeah, life is hard. Like some of these books are not meant to be taken seriously. I mean, we talked about how some of these books are dealing with really challenging issues. And then some of these books are just meant to be silly. There are books about falling in love with space aliens. So like it doesn't have to be serious. It can be silly and funny and satirical and meant to be kind of a send up. And that's enjoyable.
I've spent a lot of time in the highbrow literary community, but I find that in the romance community, if you say, oh, you know what, I haven't tried a vampire book yet, instead of any kind of shaming or how could you do that, it's like, welcome, let me give you the 5 books you need to read, and you're going to love it.
Come on in, the water's warm. Like, absolutely. There is this incredible inclusivity and just enthusiasm. And I think it's that community piece. I think it's people have experienced this joy of connectivity and community around these books, and they wanna pay that forward to other people. I mean, I've seen it happen in the store where literally two strangers will strike up a conversation about a book that they love, and it leads to a friendship. It's really amazing.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, you get to like Colleen Hoover, I always hold up as she has some really serious, dark subjects in there. Right. And yet she is held up as a romance author because she has steamy scenes. But she's dealing with, you know, you lose a child, you have an abusive parent or an abusive lover. Right. I mean, some serious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the three hallmarks of a, you know, no pun intended, the three hallmarks of a romance novel are a central love story and that it has a happy ending or a happy ever after or a happy for now. Increasingly, we're seeing a happy for now. But a lot of times authors who were not traditionally marketed as romance authors, when they have their first sort of traditional romance debut, the publishers, recognizing how popular the genre are reissuing their backlist titles as romances. So it's actually like it's changing the way that publishers are marketing as well.
Yeah, we've actually seen that with two guests on the show. We've had Callie Hart and Jennifer Armentrout, and both of them published over 20 novels on their own and are sort of just being picked up by traditional publishers now, and people are calling them debut. So I had them on the show, you know, as debut traditionally published authors.
Right. But really, they've been out here for 10 years writing, you know, perfect. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I love about romance authors is the experimentation that you see. One of my favorite authors is Sarah McLean, who writes sort of feminist historical Regency books. But last summer, she came out with her first contemporary romance that was set in Rhode Island and totally different from anything she'd written before. And so I think it's fun when these authors reinvent themselves at the same time that the publishers are kind of reintroducing them to new audiences.
From my perspective, the way that people used to find books was they would open up Book World from the Washington Post or the New York Times, right, and look to traditional print media and, you know, the very famous reviewers and see what they said are the great books. And then they would go out and buy, you know, the New York Times top 10 books or whatever. And that was sort of a self-perpetuating cycle where the people in the top 10 would keep selling and selling because people would go out and buy those top 10. But now we're seeing traditional media fall, right? People are not reading Book World. Washington Post is gone. Ron Charles is out of a job. Amazing reviewer, but is no longer reviewing for the Washington Post. And instead, we're seeing people find books through, as you mentioned, Book Talk, Insta Reels, right? There are different ways that they're finding books. And so we're seeing this fundamental change, not only in how books are being found, but then what's being sold because of that. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I have a great example of that. So Sourcebooks, which was started not very long ago, recently became one of the top five publishers. It just displaced one of the sort of big five traditional publishers. And their whole concept is identifying self-published authors who have a big fan base, often over social media, and a large backlist of titles that they've previously published that they can reissue, traditionally published, repackage. And that is their entire business model. And it is changing these authors' lives. You know, these are people that have sort of struggled for a long time to break into this market that's very competitive. And it's a really a credit to Sourcebooks for sort of finding this new model. And they're looking to social media for fan bases who have identified these authors that they love. And it's, I mean, it's crowdsourcing in the sort of most authentic sense. You know, their first breakout book was E.L. James' 50 Shades of Grey. So they were the one who sort of like plucked her from obscurity and made her a household name.
But it's funny because I feel like there are two levels, like people who are in this world, right, who are willing to read self-published books. And then you have Simon Schuster, sort of the second wave. How do you balance that?
Often we will have self-published titles on the shelves, which is not always the case in bookstores. And so we're purchasing those either sometimes directly from the authors themselves. They're getting them published through a variety of different outlets. We're purchasing them directly. Sometimes we're selling them on consignment. But one of the most popular titles in our store is by a local author named Kim Swizz. We've sold hundreds of copies of her book. She's self-published. And for a long time, she was like hand-delivering the books to the store. I mean, she would like bring them over every time we needed a restock. If we love something, we're really able to champion it.
I absolutely love that you have an author hand-delivering her self-published books.
I know. I mean, it's so funny. She would be like texting me like, hey, I saw you were down to your last copy. You want me to like run over 20 more? And I mean, very, very old school.
I love that. But that is how much the industry is changing. And, you know, that is the future.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exciting. I mean, I think for so many people, publishing is so intimidating and trying to figure out, you know, getting an agent and querying, and the whole process is so overwhelming. And self-publishing has been, I think, for a lot of people, this alternate path to this career that I think for a lot of people felt out of reach for them. You know, say what you will about e-readers, but, you know, those are very profitable for authors. And for a lot of people, that's how they're consuming their books. There is a way to, I think, combine print books with e-readers in a way that is supportive of the whole industry.
And I really wanted to have you on this show because I think that what we're seeing here is really a seismic shift in writing and reading and the entire publishing industry. And I think that Lovestruck Books, you know, romance bookstores are really on the leading edge of that. And we are going to see a big change in publishing going forward. That's my prediction. What do you think about that?
I think that's right. I mean, again, we've talked about this sort of responsiveness to online communities, and that's where authors are getting picked up. I mean, what's interesting, too, is now books will get published, and the second they get published, they're getting optioned for TV or film rights. So Alice Hoffman actually just announced that she has a new book series coming out called The Witches of Cambridge, and it's already been picked up by Hulu. The film and TV producers are in direct communication with the book publishers because they recognize that people want to see these stories in multiple formats. You know, Heated Rivalry is a great example of that. These gay hockey romance books that have been published for a while have just been exploding in popularity because HBO had a show based on the book that was incredibly popular. Now, suddenly, there's this like incredible demand for gay sports romance. You know, people will kind of like riff on the theme. It might not be hockey, it might be tennis or whatever, but you will see these trends where you'll have moments where, oh, suddenly everybody is writing about dragons. Oh, suddenly everybody is writing about queer sports players, things like that. And it's kind of fun because you see these like seasons or these cycles that the authors and the publishers go through.
And something that we see in romance in particular is that the publishing cycle is so much faster. Traditional publishing can be 2 years or more from the time a book is sold. I mean, both of my novels, A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna, 2 years from the day it was sold, not the day it was written, the day it was sold till the day it hit the bookshelves. And here you can see 1 year from the day an author sits down to write a book to the day that it hits, right, your bookstore.
I mean, even more than that, it's like when the book is getting purchased, the agent or the publisher wants to know, do you already have your next book in the hopper? So the demand is unbelievable. And I think it's because of the way people are consuming these books. They're just so ravenous for them. But yeah, these authors are churning out 2, 3, 4 books a year sometimes, which is like, I don't know how that's possible. And I think this also speaks to why publishers are reissuing backlist titles, because that's sort of like a built-in supply. I have a friend who, she goes through 5 books a week. She spends probably 3 to 4 hours a night from like, you know, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. reading. And that's like, that's her escape and that's her release. And the authors got to keep up.
I've spoken to a number of authors who feel an immense amount of pressure to get these books out because, you know, you're really not making enough money until you're 4 or 5 books into a series or, you know, into your self-publishing career. And it's really hard to keep up with that.
Yeah, it's challenging. One great example that I love is there's a new imprint called 831 Stories. They basically find sort of struggling literary fiction authors, they pitch them a story, and then they issue novellas. So they're short, and they come out with a new novella every month. And so they're pitching it to these authors in that kind of like very manageable chunk of work. So I think there's creativity and also a lot of community support for these authors. But yeah, I mean, it's a really, really hard job. I mean, I actually, when I was thinking about opening Lovestruck, the idea came to me because I wanted to write a romance novel, and then it turned out to be too hard to write a romance novel, so I just opened a store instead.
Rachel Cantor is the owner of Lovestruck Books. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Addie Kitchens was on the show last season, and since coming on the show, her book, Dominion, has blown up. It has been listed for more prizes than I have time to mention. The big ones are the Women's Prize for Fiction, the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, and the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. If you haven't read it yet, check it out and listen to our episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org, where you can find all of our past episodes. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission, is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thank you so much for listening. Read on.